From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Last month, our NBA expert suggested that the Boston Celtics were old dogs who needed to be put out of their misery. Now, the Celts are two games shy of the NBA Finals. This week on Only a Game, we'll take a look at the NBA's increasingly clear playoff picture. Also, Henry Aaron's biographer maintains that Hammer and Hank is still the people's home run king.
For the first time, you've got a gap. You've got the record holder, who is Barry Bonds, and the standard bearer, who is Henry Aaron. Henry Aaron remains the standard of excellence.
And this is the pits, but that's a good thing, as NASCAR's gas men, jack men, tire changers, and tire carriers get their annual opportunity to shine. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's too early to say that the NBA Finals will match the Boston Celtics against the Los Angeles Lakers. The Phoenix Suns haven't looked as if they can beat the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals, but stranger things have happened. And although the Celtics lead the Orlando Magic by 2-0 in the Eastern Conference Finals, both of those games have been close. But it's not too early to remind Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com of what he said in March when I asked him about those Celtics.
The team is like the family dog where you're really wondering if its quality of life has diminished to the point where it's time to euthanize. It's so hard to watch the Celtics in this decline phase. I think any Eastern Conference playoff team could potentially beat the Celtics.
Kevin Hench joins me now to explain. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Check the transcript from December when I picked them to go to the finals.
All right, but you have to explain how these pathetic mutts begging someone to put them out of their misery managed to find themselves 2 wins short of the NBA Finals.
I had no way of knowing that Kevin Garnett's new prosthetic leg would work as spectacularly as it has in these playoffs. In fairness to me, it has been quite a resurrection. I will eat a little crow. I did not see this coming. And guess who else did not see this coming? LeBron James.
No, absolutely not.
I don't think LeBron James thought he would be watching the conference finals along with the rest of us.
The final scores have been close, but the Celtics have looked as if they've been in control for most of Game 1 and Game 2 against Orlando. What do the Magic need to do to pull the proverbial rabbit out of the hat? See, it's funny because it's the Magic and the hat.
On Only a Game, and I think the Magic are treating these playoffs like, hey, it's only a game. The Celtics definitely look like they're going to work. And the Magic just don't seem to have the same level of intensity and maturity that the Celtics have. And Rashard Lewis's vanishing act has really hurt that team, because a big part of what they do is they dump the ball into Dwight Howard, they force double teams, and then they kick it out to their shooters. And when you're kicking it out to a vacant spot where Rashard Lewis used to be, I don't know where he's gone, but his disappearing act, talk about magic, his disappearing act has been a big part of the problem for the Orlando Magic.
In the Western Conference Finals, the Lakers lead Phoenix 2-0. This week, the Lakers confirmed that Kobe Bryant had fluid drained from his right knee, and injury-prone center Andrew Bynum is also suffering from a knee injury. So, do a couple of balky knees slow the Lakers down?
No, and sadly, nothing else seems able to slow the Lakers down. I mean, if Jared Dudley goes 5-for-5 from behind the three-point line, and the Suns still lose by double figures, that's a really disturbing formula. I think the Lakers, you know, they are probably the best team in basketball. But when we talked back before you started cherry-picking quotes from me, and we talked before the playoffs, I said, you know, the teams that I thought would give the Lakers potentially the hardest time throughout the playoffs were the Mavericks, the Nuggets, and the Cavaliers. So Spurs took care of the Mavericks, the Jazz took care of the Nuggets, and the Celtics took care of the Cavaliers. No one has been having more fun in these playoffs than the Lakers. First, they blow out whoever they play. Then they get to sit back and watch some other team take care of a potentially dangerous foe so that they can get the squishy, soft Suns in the finals. Oh, it has just been a cakewalk for these Lakers, and it looks like they are going to their third finals in a row.
Phoenix scored 107 points in Game 1, then put up 112 in Game 2. Unfortunately for them, the Lakers had 128 and 124 in those games. Is it time for Suns fans to kind of practice their defense chant?
Well, I don't know. I don't think chanting can do anything about the indifferent approach of the players. That is just not a team that can dig down physically and get stops. Nobody can really guard Kobe Bryant, but that's almost the least of their worries because they're just so soft down low that Pau Gasol, Andrew Bynum, and Lamar Odom are just going to have their way. And the Lakers, I don't know, they're obviously battle-tested, but they really are spanking the Suns in a kind of humiliating way. And sadly, because I'm a big fan of his, making Steve Nash look 45 years old.
Meanwhile, for fans in Cleveland, the matter of who wins the championship probably seems a lot less compelling than the question of what LeBron James will decide to do. Several cities have launched campaigns, or at least cyber campaigns, to attract him. Cleveland and Akron are trying to convince him to stay with the Cavs. Any predictions?
If he is truly interested in winning a title, which would seem to be at this point the one thing he hasn't done, I think Chicago is such a logical place for him because if you pair him with Derrick Rose, there is no chance, and I'm never wrong about these things, Bill, there is no chance that they will not win multiple championships in the next 5 years.
And finally, though I'm not sure why I should pay attention to your answer, I will ask you which team is going to win the championship this year.
Well, 2 years ago, when the Celtics blew out the Lakers in Game 6 of the NBA Finals, I said that Laker fans should stop crying because they're going to win the championship in 2009. In the beginning of this year, I said the Lakers were the best team. I don't think that's changed. I may have been wrong pouring dirt on the Boston Celtics, but I have not been wrong about these Lakers, and I believe the Celtics and the Lakers meet in the finals, and the Lakers win in 6 games.
Kevin Hinch, a good sport, if there ever was one, covers sports for FoxSports.com, writes screenplays, hobnobs with famous basketball players, and somehow finds time to talk to me at Only a Game as well. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Bill.
On his way into the Argentine Football Association headquarters to announce the team's World Cup roster, Diego Maradona ran over a photographer's leg with his blue Mini Cooper. While the man lay injured, Argentina's fiery coach yelled vulgar insults at the photographer for getting in the way. As Ian Mount reports from Buenos Aires, Thursday's incident is just the latest in Maradona's long and colorful history.
Just as Americans of a certain age can pinpoint their location when JFK was shot, most Argentines over 35 can say exactly where they were when Diego Armando Maradona wove through the English national team and knocked in the goal of the century in the 1986 World Cup. 3 minutes earlier, Maradona had gotten away with the scam of the tournament, a handball goal that will forever be known as the Hand of God. But with his game-winning second score, Maradona became immortal in the eyes of his countrymen. 4 years before, England had routed Argentina in the Falklands War, and tiny 5'5" Maradona had just exacted revenge.
He's offered Argentina some of its most sublime moments. One specifically was the most perfect in the history of Argentine society. Never again in such a unanimous way would we experience a moment of joy that complete.
That's Victor Hugo Morales, Argentina's top sportscaster and the man who narrated the 1986 game. It's hard to overestimate the importance of soccer, and therefore Maradona, in Argentina. The country's 2010 World Cup games will be piped into public school classrooms, for example. And Maradona is a legend, the combative little kid from a Buenos Aires shanty town who brought down England.
Diego es,
Diego is the best player of all time, says Alejandro Beron, the co-founder of the 80,000-member Church of Maradona fan club. He is Argentina's most important ambassador, for good or ill, and he is the voice for those who have none. And so, it's not entirely surprising that after the current national team struggled during the qualifying round, Maradona was charged with leading Argentina in the World Cup again, this time as coach. Last October, when the Maradona coach team almost guaranteed itself a World Cup spot with a last-minute win against Peru, Maradona belly-flopped across the wet field like a muddy penguin, and the fans exploded with joy. It seemed like the Maradona magic was back. But the Maradona of 2010 doesn't attract the same universal admiration as the 1986 version. In the intervening years, Maradona has been arrested for drug possession, cycled through rehab, got tossed from the 1994 World Cup for a positive drug test, lost most of his money, and ballooned to nearly 300 pounds. For parts of polite society, Maradona was always too crude and combative, and his naming as Argentine coach was a national embarrassment.
He's a figure who inspires love and hate in equal measure, so he's watched at all times.
That's Cynthia Majol, who, along with her husband Gaston, stood amidst the celebrations after the Peru win. Here's Gaston.
I think he's a person who's made himself into a celebrity, insulting people, being irreverent.
Maradona's divisiveness came to a head after Argentina finally clinched a spot in the World Cup by beating Uruguay in the last qualifying game. Maradona took advantage of his post-game press conference to dress down those who'd criticized him because Argentina's uniquely talented dream team had almost failed to make the cut.
Yo soy o blanco o negro.
I'm black or white. I'll never be gray in my life, eh? And to those who treated me like you did, you can me.
Since then, as the unthinkable prospect of missing the World Cup has faded, and Argentines rush to buy flat-screen TVs to watch the tournament, his team has won several friendlies, including one against powerhouse Germany, and he's grown a distinguished gray beard. On a dirt playground in the Buenos Aires neighborhood of San Telmo, a group of teenagers play a pickup game. They don't think Maradona is a great coach, and they don't sugarcoat his past, but he still serves as an inspiration. He was poor, says 14-year-old Nathanael. He got out of a shantytown by playing soccer because he had to. And after he grew up, he got into drugs. In Argentina, Nathanael says, Maradona shows that anyone can accomplish his dreams. If Maradona's team manages to accomplish Argentina's dream of winning a third World Cup, Victor Hugo Morales may have to reenact his 1986 Maradona narration. For Only a Game, I'm Ian Mount.
I bet number 10 will do it again, score twice. The crowd will be chanting his name and all.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Off the field, FC St. Pauli, the soccer team that had been operating in Germany's second division, has employed a two-pronged strategy to achieve success. FC St. Pauli's stadium includes a chapel-themed executive box featuring candles, an altar to football, and stained glass windows depicting the players as saints. On the other hand, or perhaps the other foot, as this is soccer, many of the team's fans attend games dressed in clothes that bear the skull and crossbones. They embrace an anti-authoritarian image that includes the motto, non-established since 1910. This season, the combination of approaches worked. FC St. Pauli earned promotion to the Bundesliga for the first time in 8 years. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the NASCAR event that's all over in 23.123 seconds. But first, after Game 3 of the NHL's Western Conference Finals, San Jose Sharks coach Todd McClellan said, "We've been in this series every game. That's got to leave us feeling good." The part about feeling good had to be something of a reach. The Sharks fell to the Chicago Blackhawks in overtime last night, 3-2. Chicago leads the series 3-0. The two teams will meet again tomorrow night in Chicago, where the Blackhawks will try to reach the Stanley Cup final for the first time since 1992. In the Eastern Conference Finals, the Philadelphia Flyers lead the Montreal Canadiens 2-1. They'll play Game 4 of that series today in Montreal. The NASCAR Hall of Fame in Charlotte, North Carolina, opened last Tuesday and drew 10,000 visitors in its first week, and that's before the first class had even been inducted. Bill France Sr., Bill France Jr., Richard Petty, Dale Earnhardt, and Junior Johnson will be enshrined in the hall on Sunday. Joining me now is Sports Illustrated writer Brant James. Brant, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The city of Charlotte owns and operates this Hall of Fame. City officials said this week that the opening was intentionally planned for a week when there wasn't a major race in town and school was still in session to make sure the hall wasn't overwhelmed with visitors. Do you expect that that will soon be the case?
Yeah, I think this is going to be a very popular destination. It's going to be, you know, part Smithsonian, part amusement park, and you know, a lot of good memories. For anyone who enjoys that kind of racing, they're really going to enjoy the place, I think.
I like amusement park. Does that mean people will be getting into AirSats race cars and putting the pedal to the metal?
Exactly. You're encouraged to go as fast as you can to the lobby. Burnout's encouraged. No, I think they're trying to incorporate modern technology as far as presenting the media in ways that are going to capture young fans, older fans, and you know, take advantage of all the, you know, the benefits they had of creating a brand new building in a brand new media environment. So I think there's going to be things there for all attention spans.
As I mentioned, the hall's first induction ceremony is tomorrow. Did the nominating and voting committees get it right?
They got it pretty close, I think. I mean, there certainly hasn't been any public outrage about the class. It was, you know, definitely a difficult project when you have about a half century worth of history to, you know, to winnow down into a first class. Major League Baseball was in that predicament when they began, and you know, they had that monstrous first class, maybe the greatest first class to ever go into a Hall of Fame. There are people who thought maybe two Frances, you know, two members of the founding family shouldn't have been in the first five person class. You know, Dale Earnhardt was obviously going to be there. Richard Petty had to be there. Junior Johnson, you figured he should be there. He made sense on so many levels as an owner, a driver, sort of an arc back to the, you know, beginnings of the sport, and such an icon in the sport. You know, maybe one of the Frances comes out, maybe David Pearson goes in, which was sort of how I would like to have seen it. But they have a lot of catching up to do, and they'll sweep all the greats in there eventually.
You mentioned Junior Johnson. That, of course, hooks NASCAR's present back into its moonshine-running past, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. And, again, he's the connector. He's a thread. He's seen both sides of those bars as they clink shut when Johnny Law is cross with you. And, you know, it's amazing. You know, this sport romanticizes law-breaking, you know, that they were engaging in illegal activity. But that's sort of been Robin Hooded, I guess, and there's even a still in the Hall of Fame, and from what I'm told, the people that were putting it together to display in the Hall of Fame couldn't quite get it right, and Junior had to get some wrenches and move over and then help him work it out. Now, I don't know if that violated any sort of law.
I'm sure it's there for amusement purposes only.
I'm not sure of that at all. No, I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. But it's a lot more valuable if it works now, isn't it?
Absolutely. Only two of the first five inductees are still living, Richard Petty and Junior Johnson. Was there a push to include more than five the first time around just so the platform would have more people on it?
I don't think so. From talking, you know, informally with a lot of people involved with NASCAR and the Hall of Fame, it seems that the Hall of Fame was constructed and laid out that each year it would be a five-person class. And I think they, even though they do have, you know, a half century's worth of participation to catch up on and drivers to catch up on. I think they really wanted to create an air of exclusivity. I think, you know, they want each class, especially the early ones, you know, just sort of be the titans. And, I mean, you look at all the drivers, the owners, the mechanics, and everyone they have to catch up on, they're going to go a decade where, you know, it's going to be a breathtaking class. There's not going to be anyone in those first five or ten classes where you think, well, that's marginal. It's going to be strong, and I think they like it that way. They want the impact of it.
Well, what five names do you like for 2011?
David Pearson needs to be absolutely unanimous, especially, you know, I thought he should have been in the first class. Richard Petty, you know, calls him maybe the greatest driver of all time. You really can't get a better endorsement than that. He needs to be in there, and I fully look forward to his acceptance speech because that's an interesting character. I think Bobby Allison, he should be in there. Lee Petty, not only the father of the man who's the winningest driver in series history, but you know, a three-time champion in his own right. Continuing on into the modern era, you get Darrell Waltrip in there, not only a multiple champion, but you know, very known as a broadcaster, and Cale Yarborough, you know, harkening back to the three straight championships, 76, 7, and 8. No one had done that until Jimmy Johnson surpassed him this year. Just another character, you know, lived off cans of black-eyed peas when he was when he was poor and trying to get his break in the sport, and just a great old character. I think he needs to be in there too. I think that's probably going to be the crux of the next class.
You know, I've noticed that badminton, bowling, and shuffleboard have long had their own halls of fame. Why has it taken NASCAR so long to come up with this idea?
Well, I think part of it is there are, it seems like, hundreds of halls of fame. They're everywhere. It seems like almost every state, most racetracks have a hall of fame. And for years and years, NASCAR just didn't sanction one. And I think there was just the proper confluence of a desire of NASCAR to put all of its history in one place, to put its name on something, to sanction something, and just sort of marshal the will of a city to get behind it. You know, Atlanta wanted it. Kansas City was interested in it. Daytona Beach was interested in it. A lot of people thought it belonged in Charlotte. And the city of Charlotte got behind it and, began to understand it as a possibility of a major tourist destination. So I think it took 50 years, but I think the timing was finally right.
Brant James writes about NASCAR for Sports Illustrated. Brant, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
It'll be a long, long time before the NASCAR Hall of Fame inducts anyone who spent a majority of their career toiling on a pit crew. But as Dave DeWitt reports from Charlotte, it's the guys in the pits who make the difference.
A typical NASCAR Sprint Cup race is won by just a few seconds or less, like this year's Daytona 500, won by Jamie McMurray.
Crash at the back, never mind. Green flag still out. Checkered flag in the air. The 52nd Daytona 500 McMurray! To Jamie
yes!
McMurray.
Yes! Little Jamie, baby!
After the checkered flag, the scene is always the same. The winning driver cruises down victory lane, jumps on top of his car, drinks and sprays whatever beverage sponsors that car, and then it's awkward high fives and hugs with some other guys who are wearing similar jumpsuits. Those other guys, they're the pit crew, and they have titles that leave little doubt about their role. Rear tire changer, front tire carrier, jackman, gasman. The drivers, the ones who earn all the money and star in TV ads and get to kiss the pretty girls on the victory stand, they know who gets them to victory lane and what it takes to work in the pits. Here's driver Greg Biffle.
They have a very dangerous job. We're parallel parking at 55 miles an hour. I mean, I'm driving by people's feet that are 3 inches away, and they have got to be. They are a hell of an athlete to do what they are doing.
Some NASCAR naysayers may chuckle at the use of the word athlete when describing the guys on the pit crew, but that would be a mistake. About 75% of them played a sport in college. They're former linebackers or catchers or defensemen, and they're highly competitive.
Yeah, I'm Kurt Bowman, and I'm the gas man.
Kurt Bowman is a member of the pit crew for the number 31 Caterpillar Chevrolet, driven by Jeff Burton. He's an inverted mountain of a man, thin at the waist and broad at the shoulder, with a head like a flesh-colored melon. His dad took him to races as a kid, and when he left the military, he devoted his life to racing.
I mean, if you're not competitive, you're not going to survive in this business for a year, much less 20. I want to be the best at whatever I do, and it kills me if I'm not.
Bowman's been going over the wall at racetracks for 22 years. It's his full-time job, and he's invaluable to his team, says his pit crew coach, Matt Clark.
Oh, Kurt is the heartbeat, the heart and soul. He bleeds this pit crew deal. He bleeds the competition. He bleeds racing. I mean, he is honestly a model athlete for me.
There are only a couple of ways a pit crew member gets into the spotlight. One is bad, when he makes a mistake that loses a race, like what happened last week to Clint Bowyer's Jackman at Dover. Bowyer got back onto the track after a pit stop, and something came with him.
Bangs another car, and oh my goodness.
Hell, Jack's still on the car.
Yeah, says Mike Dillon, the spotter, and he will come back, have that removed, and serve a penalty.
Not a great day for the Jackman. But there's one night a year when he and the gas can catcher and the other guys on the pit crew get more positive attention.
All right, folks, let's meet the members from the Meridian Amp Energy National Guard team. The gas man is Chris Fasuka. The catch can, Aaron Walker.
The pit crew challenge is 7 years old, and it's NASCAR's answer to the dunk contest and home run derby. It draws the hardest of hardcore fans to Charlotte's downtown arena during the 2 weeks when the Sprint Cup Series parks in its de facto home base for Saturday's All-Star Race and next Sunday's Coca-Cola 600. The competition incorporates all the elements of a regular pit stop, with the added bonus of pushing a car 30 yards across a finish line. It's a wild 23 seconds.
Team's ready, set.
It looks chaotic, but a pit stop, whether it's during a race or in an arena, is choreographed to the tenth of a second. Kurt Bowman, the gas man, measures his steps like a football place kicker. One slip or misstep, and he's losing control of an 80-pound, 6-foot-tall gas can, as well as losing a race. The tire changers have a job that's just as tough, throwing themselves onto the ground around the car twice while carrying a high-speed air gun. One missed lug nut, and you're done, even in a made-for-TV event.
Looks like the 88 is clean with no penalties.
Kurt Bowman and the number 31 Caterpillar Chevy won the pit crew challenge last year, and they were flawless in advancing into the finals of this year's tournament.
It's going to be the number 31 Caterpillar Chevrolet, the defending champs, trying to make it two in a row against last year's semifinalist, the number 11 FedEx Toyota.
The number 31 team falls behind early in the final. After the tires are changed and the gas is dumped in, they get to the push car a half a second after the FedEx team. A few seconds later, it's all over.
Congratulations! The number 11 FedEx Toyota team from Joe Gibbs Racing!
Exhausted and covered in sweat, Bowman sits down slowly on the pit wall as the other team celebrates.
And it stinks, you know. I hate to lose, we all do. But they're a good bunch of guys, and their gas man goes to the same barber I do. So me and him are pretty good buddies, so I'm happy for him anyway. I hate losing.
In this event, losers get nothing, but each winning pit crew member earns $10,000. That's real money to these guys, who, when the races start up again this weekend, will return to anonymity. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt in Charlotte, North Carolina. On the road again. I
just can't wait to get on that road again. Get off the road and onto the information superhighway. You can visit our website at onlyagame.org or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Username Only a Game Radio. You're listening to Only a Game. In 2007, the publication of his As Told To book, Positively False, gave me the opportunity to speak with Floyd Landis. Landis had won the 2006 Tour de France, then been stripped of his title when tests indicated that he'd been doping. Landis disputed the test results and accused the testers of playing politics.
I happened to be in the middle of a fight between the anti-doping agencies and the sport of cycling. They take advantage of cycling because of its publicity. Cycling is, for them, the best way to get their message out. And so they do anything they can to catch any cyclist that they can.
After waging a long and expensive battle to discredit the tests and those conducting them, Floyd Landis acknowledged on Tuesday that he had cheated for much of his career, that he had in fact done more than he'd been accused of doing. Landis chose to make his confession via a one-hour phone call to ESPN.com's Bonnie D. Ford, one of the many people to whom Landis had been lying for 4 years. Though Ford hadn't been expecting the call, Landis's revelations didn't shock her.
No, I was not surprised. I'm never surprised. I've learned not to be surprised in cycling or any other elite sport. But I was glad in the sense that we could just clear up the historical record.
In addition to confessing his own transgressions, Floyd Landis accused Lance Armstrong and more than a dozen other riders and trainers in cycling's top rank of breaking the rules. Because Landis has acknowledged that he has no evidence to support his accusations, the charges may lead nowhere, though some of them seem marvelously precise. Landis says, for example, that he stayed in Lance Armstrong's apartment in Spain because Armstrong had asked him to make sure the electricity didn't go out, thus causing the bags of blood in the refrigerator to spoil, which would have prevented Armstrong from the blood doping he had planned to do. Bonnie Ford doesn't think this week's news will alter how most people view the man who's won the Tour de France 7 times.
I think people made up their minds about Lance Armstrong a long time ago. I think there are people who believe that he's clean and people who don't. I don't think Floyd Landis is going to have much impact on those two camps.
An awful lot of people would have paid no attention to professional cycling this week if Floyd Landis hadn't grown a conscience, and this is not one of those cases in which any publicity is good publicity. People determined to view professional cycling optimistically will regard Landis's accusations as old news. They will maintain that ever more effective testing and the determination of current riders to reestablish the integrity of their sport has put Floyd Landis and others who've doped in cycling's rearview mirror. And they will continue to wish, as they have been wishing for some time, that Floyd Landis would finally just go away. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. Summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
It was meant as a joke, obviously, but it went too far. How many times have stories following mayhem and disaster begun this way? In this particular case, the speaker was Lake Tahoe Unified School District Superintendent James Tarwater, and the it was the coach of the South Tahoe High School softball team, inviting players who had struck out during that day's game to drink soda from a baseball shoe belonging to one of their teammates. Was it hazing? Well, probably depends on the temperature of the beverage and definitely on the condition of the shoe. I mean, if it was an old sneaker, stinky and everything, woo, yeah, but a relatively new, relatively clean leather baseball shoe with ice in it or a straw and one of those little pink umbrellas? Maybe not. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Henry Aaron reconsidered in the late innings. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Not many alleged experts would have predicted it when the NBA playoffs began, but it's looking a lot like the finals will pit the Lakers against the Celtics, isn't it?
Yes, and you can tell that by the handsprings down Fifth Avenue that people in the NBA home offices are doing. The Celtics are following the pattern laid down by the last Bill Russell championship team in 1969, which is basically to sandbag coast, guard against injuries for most of the regular season, and then zap through the playoffs. And the Lakers are simply better than the Phoenix Suns.
All right, Charlie, you have never been shy about criticizing NBA officiating, and neither was a fan in Orlando on Tuesday night. NBA referee Joe DeRosa got tired of being heckled and threw a game ball at a disgruntled fan who may or may not have been Wyndham Vacation Ownership CEO Franz Hanning. DeRosa's been suspended one day without pay. How long would a player or coach be suspended for throwing a ball at a heckler?
More to the point. First of all, he didn't throw the ball at him. He sort of tossed it in the guy's lap, and the guy tossed it back. Second of all, this guy's the president and CEO of a major company. I would like his board of directors to tell me how they feel about this guy being a jackass all over the inner tubes for the future. Does DeRosa need to be suspended? Yeah, he shouldn't have done what he did. But you know what? I think anybody else gets thrown out of that arena and not, quote-unquote, relocated to another seat.
The Philadelphia 76ers have signed a new coach, former Sixer and TNT analyst Doug Collins. Collins' previous coaching career ended in 2003 with a mediocre record, 332 and 287. What do you think? Has he learned anything from his time on TV that will help him on the sideline?
Well, he should have learned that the Philadelphia 76ers job is a no-win situation because they could bring Red Auerbach back from the dead and he wouldn't win with that team. But why not hand the team over to the single coach in the history of basketball who couldn't win a championship with Michael Jordan?
I know you're rooting for Chicago to beat San Jose and Montreal to top Philadelphia for an original six Stanley Cup final, Charlie, but despite a big win on Thursday night, the Canadiens are still down 2-1. Can they come back to win?
Sure they can. This is shaping up like a classic home team series. Montreal will tie it up, they'll go down, they'll lose, and probably Philadelphia will win it in the seventh game. I hope that isn't the way it turns out, but that's the way it looks right now. If Montreal couldn't score anything in Philadelphia, they came up, they got 5 goals the first game they play at home. They're still playing against a backup goaltender in Michael Layton and will for the entire series. I think it'll go 7 games, and I hate to say it, but I think Philadelphia will probably win the seventh game in their own building.
In an interview with Sports Illustrated this week, Demora Smith, the head of the NFL Players Association, was asked, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely it was that there would be a lockout after the 2010-2011 season, and his reply was 14. Does this strike you as pessimistic?
No, but I think, you know, this is a very sharp guy. This is a guy who isn't quite as far in the pocket of management as the previous leadership of the NFLPA were, and I think, you know, if the union says they're going to be locked out, chances are they're going to be locked out.
I'm sure that you'll be happy to learn that Brett Favre has finally set the conditions under which he will return for yet one more year as quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings. But could you please explain to me what that condition has to do with the sport of football?
Oh, absolutely nothing, but he's trying to fire up the Southern Mississippi baseball team. He's, of course, a grad of Southern Mississippi and was a Golden Eagle quarterback. He told them that if they make the College World Series for the second straight year, he'll come back for one more year in the NFL. And it makes more sense
exactly.
than a lot of things that Brett Favre does in the offseason.
And has done for the past several years. Back in 2006, Floyd Landis was stripped of his Tour de France title for doping. He denied any wrongdoing for several years. He embarked on a very expensive legal battle, financed mostly by other people's money, to clear his name. And then this week he acknowledged that he had not only done what he'd been accused of doing, he'd injected and ingested lots and lots of other stuff as well. Why didn't he just come clean in the first place?
Because he wasn't plugging a book in the first place, Bill. That's the thing.
How silly of me not to have recognized that.
This is a very interesting argument that young Floyd is making now. Now he's saying all of his arguments, all of his lawsuits, and one previous book have all been a lie, but he's telling the truth now, and that he didn't take the drugs he was accused of taking, and that those tests were still bad, but he took almost everything else.
And they didn't test him for it. Ryan Nelson, the captain of New Zealand's soccer team, said this week that he thought England was going to win the World Cup in South Africa. Isn't it customary for players, especially captains, to say they think their own teams will win?
Well, I think Ryan's probably the living definition of just happy to be here, folks. New Zealand's at the World Cup for the first time since 1982, and it's in a group with among other people, defending champion Italy. I think that Ryan's being very open-minded here, and everyone should applaud him for his honesty.
All right, I'm not surprised that neither Kevin Costner nor Ray Liotta, two well-known Hollywood actors, expressed any interest in buying land in Iowa this week. But I guess there are some folks who are shocked and dismayed by that. Why is that?
Apparently, it's the Field of Dreams site, the famous ballpark carved out of the cornfield in one of the most execrable sports movies of all time.
That's a distinction.
I'm telling you, it's up for sale now, and it looks like that Kevin Costner, who played Ray Kinsella, the semi-hippie farmer, and Ray Liotta, who in a movie dedicated to the history and lore of baseball, managed to play Shoeless Joe Jackson batting from the wrong side of the plate, have neither one of them wants this thing. And for me, plant the corn again, please.
In tennis news, Rafael Nadal beat Roger Federer to win the Madrid Masters on Sunday, and Mr. Nadal is favored in the French Open as well. But I'm saving my tennis enthusiasm for Wimbledon, which, for the first time this summer, will feature an official championships poet. I sing today of rackets and of tennis balls and nets, or I could sing of players on the sideline making bets. Think I have a shot at being named one of the championship's poets?
There once was a player from Nantucket. No, I'm sorry. I think you got a shot, Bill. I really do.
Yeah, I think so. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Historian, tomorrow's issue profiles Boston Red Sox manager Terry Francona. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In 1974, Henry Aaron broke baseball's most glamorous record. Thereafter, he brooded about how people didn't seem to care about anything else that he'd done. Throughout his very long and productive major league career, Aaron built a reputation for exceptional consistency. He was much admired for quiet professionalism, especially as that quality became less evident in those who followed him. In part, these qualities explain why Howard Bryant titled his biography of Henry Aaron, The Last Hero. Howard Bryant joins me now in the studio. Howard, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
I want to start with Vin Scully's call of Henry Aaron's 715th home run on April 8th, 1974, which baseball fans had, of course, been anticipating for some time.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting. The outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone.
Now, Mr. Scully let the crowd roar without interruption for almost 2 minutes after he said that, and then he provided his take on the significance of that home run and its aftermath.
What a marvelous moment for baseball. What a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the deep South for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol. And it is a great moment for all of us, and particularly for Henry Aaron, who was met at...
Howard, was that an overstatement?
I don't think it was an overstatement. I think it was a great call by Vin Scully, and it's a forgotten call in its own way, because we always hear the Milo Hamilton call, which is accompanied with the video whenever we see it on television. It's not something that we think about today as being overly important. But at the time, you have to remember, he was the first African-American star of any sport to play in the Deep South. And the strategy of the heavy hitters down there, of Ivan Allen, the mayor of Atlanta, and Jimmy Carter, soon to be governor, and Dr. King, all of them felt to become a big city, you had to have sports. Sports was going to be the thing that separated you from your past. So it was not a small thing.
I was surprised to learn from your book that Henry Aaron would tell a different story about his origins each time he was asked about them. That sounds more like Satchel Paige or maybe Bill Lee. Why did Henry Aaron do that?
Well, I think he was a little nervous and a little embarrassed. I think he felt overmatched when it came to public speaking. He hated public speaking. He was a little intimidated about his lack of education. One of the things that people have always said about him was that he is an introvert who was placed in an extrovert's role. Mm. He's gotten much, much better at it. I think he enjoys the fact that people respect him and the fact that he's had success. But he's not Ted Williams. He was not Willie Mays or not one of those people who, when the spotlight went on, he immediately got into character.
Chuck Tanner, who eventually managed in the major leagues, knew Henry Aaron in the minors as a fellow player, and he told you that Aaron, quote, made everything look so easy that even the writers hated him at first. Does that perhaps begin to explain the chip that Henry Aaron seemed to carry on his shoulder?
Well, certainly because of what it translated to, and what it translated to was a fair amount of racism in the way he was perceived. If you look at Joe DiMaggio, it was very funny. Henry would always bring this up, that DiMaggio's silence equals class. My silence equals stupidity. Mm. And he glided. That's what Chuck Taylor, I remember we sat in Bradenton, Florida, having this conversation, and he talked about how much Henry glided. And yet he was not portrayed in those early years in the 50s as a graceful player, but more of a kind of a minstrel character. They called him Slow Motion Henry. And I can't think of any other players that they referred to that the newspapers called a shuffler. And devastating profile in the Saturday Evening Post, which essentially referred to him as step and fetch it. You don't forget that.
I want to present one statistic to suggest just how consistent Henry Aaron was as a hitter. From 1957, his fourth season in the majors, until 1973, he never hit more than 47 home runs, but he hit fewer than 30 only once. How unusual is that level of production over such a long period of time?
Well, it's incredible. The stat that I like most about Henry Aaron is that here is a player who had 3,771 hits for a power hitter, 3,771. And Joe Torre told me the story about how in 1963-64, you could see him distance himself from being that consistent line drive hitter into a power hitter. And I always wonder what his career numbers would have been if he had continued on that arc. He might have been the first player. He would have passed Cobb. He would have had 4,000 hits and 600 home runs instead of 755. I think it's fascinating to be that good to decide which all-time record you want to break.
As Aaron approached Babe Ruth's record of 714 career home runs, he's reported to have received a lot of hate mail, including numbers of death threats. You present stories in the book that suggest that Aaron allegedly kept the letters and would reread them as the years went by.
Sure.
Why
did
he do that?
I think when you talk to his friends, the people very close to him, they will tell you that it's a very sober, very bitter reminder about his journey. And that was also one of the things that I found so compelling about him, is that he does provide a timeline for America. He's a black man born in 1934 in the Deep South, in the Great Depression. And one of the themes that I kept asking myself during this project was, which vision of Henry Aaron wins for him? Is it when you were a kid and you just watched the humiliation of your family, of your parents? Or is it today as a 76-year-old national icon who's slept in the White House and he's met kings and queens? And then I realized that it was not a fair question to ask him, because you can't have one without the other.
In the introduction to The Last Hero, you quote an unnamed Henry confidant, I don't know who it was, as saying, quote, Willie Mays ceased being a person the day he retired. Who did Willie Mays ever help except Willie? You included that in the introduction. Did it strike you as a fair characterization of Willie Mays?
I put it in the introduction as a counter to this notion that Henry Aaron was going to be viewed simply for what he did on the baseball field. And in comparison to Mays, the reason why Henry still has relevance today is because in retirement, he is a player who really wanted to break down the doors that Robinson never got to. Integration in the front office, integration in the manager's office, to make sure that African-American players still had opportunities outside of the game or even in the game because the numbers are declining so much. In Mays's case, the narrative of Willie Mays really has stopped after he retired in 1973. The point of it was not necessarily to criticize Willie. It was also to say that there is a second act here.
All right. Regarding Barry Bonds, who broke Henry Aaron's home run record, you quote Aaron as saying, if a player is elected to the Hall of Fame who's known to have used steroids, there ought to be an asterisk or something mentioned on the plaque that he used steroids. In the record section at the end of your book, where it says Aaron is second in career home runs, were you tempted to include an asterisk there to indicate that he's still sort of first?
No, he's the people's champion. Barry Bonds is the home run leader. And I really enjoyed the interview that I had with Dr. Harry Edwards, a sociologist out in California, who had said that for the first time, you've got a gap. You've got the record holder, who is Barry Bonds, and the standard bearer, who is Henry Aaron. And for the first time in baseball history, the standard of excellence and the record holder are two different people. Henry Aaron remains the standard of excellence.
It's an interesting distinction because you do also mention that the Braves locker room into which Henry Aaron walked on every game day featured a great big glass jar full of greenies,
amphetamines,
and they were just as illegal as steroids without a prescription at the time, and yet I don't know whether Aaron was taking them, but some of his teammates certainly were.
No, sure, and all those players, Henry Aaron included, admitted to using them on occasion, if not frequently. I made the distinction not to equate, and in my writing today, I don't equate anabolic steroids with amphetamine simply because I'm a muscle mass person. There's a big difference between creating and building muscle mass and alertness. Sure, being more alert makes you a better player. But I do make the distinction between performance-enhancing drugs and workplace doping. To me, amphetamines are an example of workplace doping, no different than truck drivers or college kids who are trying to cram their way through the semester. I'm not saying that it's not important and that those drugs aren't illegal, but steroids are a totally different animal. Human growth hormone, gene doping, gene therapy, totally different animal.
Howard Bryant is the author of The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron, published by Pantheon Books. Howard, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Yesterday, or was it today, when Hank he wiped those the records away? Now what I'll see from now on, the record to be his very own. Last home run was the last home run. Hank was going some when he hit the last home run. Go, man!
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Jack Flagler and Peter Anybody But the Celtics Lydotes. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to sign up for our podcast, read my review of The Last Hero, or revisit stories past or present, please visit onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, username onlyagameradio. In our final word, ESPN.com's Bonnie D. Ford explains the downside of getting a major scoop, which draws the TV crews.
This is why I'm a writer, because I can't be perky once an hour for 2 minutes.
Yeah, send them over here, Bonnie. I can do perky. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Even hit fortune and fame, he messed up another great legend name. Wreck I see, been so long, has been toned down and now it's all gone. Last home run, but the last home run.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year, and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health using video games to promote health innovations at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.